Good morning.
Hi.
I don't know about you, but and I'm not much of a kind of a warm and emotional guy, but I find myself, as we approach the inauguration, actually getting teary-eyed. I was driving over here listening to NPR and had interviews with folks, realizing tomorrow's Martin Luther King Day. It's just quite, I think, quite a remarkable time for this country, for this society. And I just want to acknowledge that. Today I'm going to talk about Kshanti. It is one of the six perfections in Mahayana Buddhism. And it's variably translated as patience, endurance, forbearance, and even inclusiveness. The paramitas are, there's again, depending on how you count them, there's either six or ten. The translation is perfection. The Chinese ideogram for, I'll back up. There are six of them. We'll go with the six. They are sometimes talked about as the raft that gets you from one shore to the other. The raft that takes you from the world of samsara and suffering to the shore of nirvana. Sometimes they're talked about like that. In some ways, in Mahayana Buddhism, which rose about 2,000 years ago as a sort of a reformation or a reconceptualization of Buddhism, the perfections came about. And in some ways, they're focused on as the precepts were prior to that in Theravadan Buddhism. So they take that kind of focus. They're considered not guidelines as much as they are inspirations, something to inspire us. So the six are generosity, morality, patience, zeal, meditation, jhana, and wisdom. So those are the six perfections, and I'm going to talk about one of them, patience, kshanti. Thich Nhat Hanh talks a little bit about, I'm going to read a little quote from him. He talks about the need for effort. So we have these inspirations, generosity, morality, patience, zeal, meditation, and wisdom. But it takes some effort. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, "Don't just hope for the other shore to come to you. If you want to cross over to the other shore, the shore of safety, well-being, non-fear, and non-anger, you have to swim or row across. You have to make an effort. The effort is the practice of the six paramitas." So Kshanti, as I said, it is sometimes translated as patience, endurance, forbearance, or inclusiveness. It is the antidote to fear and anger. It is the virtue that overcomes fear and anger. And in Buddhism, there are three poisons, one of which is anger, hatred. The other is, the other two are greed and delusion. Those are fundamental states of consciousness in the Buddhist worldview, the three things that get us really messed up as we try to live in equanimity and peace: hatred, greed, and delusion. Shanti, or patience, is the virtue that overcomes hatred. It is the antidote to hatred. It's traditionally viewed that there are three different types of patience. One is forgiveness, or gentle forbearance. It's seeing the context of what arises if someone says something nasty to you, if someone cuts you off as you're driving on the highway. It's realizing it's not about me. It's not about me. I mean, there's a context to causes and conditions about why things arise. As some of you know, my work is doing housing for people with AIDS. And I was having a conversation yesterday, actually, over breakfast with a fellow who, when he retired from a similar agency to mine, the two agencies merged. So I had a history with him, a professional collegial history. And we were with a number of people that were his colleagues and friends, and we were talking about a project that I did about 4 or 5 years ago, which was to build an apartment building for people living with HIV and AIDS. And John reminded or told this group about the great patience and forbearance that I demonstrated in the process of building this, getting this constructed. I remember there was a lot of hatred. I remember people, one person, a fairly significant politician in that part of town we were trying to build this, say under his breath, why don't you keep those people over there, meaning St. Paul, which is where my agency had its headquarters. When we were trying to convince the neighborhood to, or get them to warm up to our project, we brought a few of them to supportive housing, affordable housing development in the Elliott Park neighborhood, just to show them that affordable housing, supportive housing could look good, it could feel good, it could regenerate a neighborhood. And I remember one of the fellows who was actually one of the supporters of our project, because he had a brother who had died of AIDS. When I brought him to this affordable housing site to show him what could be there, he kind of blew me away when he said, there are too many black people. We don't want that in our neighborhood. There are too many black people. I remember we didn't do ourselves a lot of good at times. When I first was part of that, when I first got that job, the project was already had this piece of property, and I went to my first meeting of the neighborhood association. And because I was new to my job, I didn't have to get up in front of the neighborhood board and make the presentation. My board president did that, along with a consultant. And I since learned, and that board president is a wonderful, wonderful guy, but I since learned that he lacks a little control, a little kind of what he thinks is right out there. And in the middle of this meeting, one of the guys in the neighborhood board asked the board president, told him, why do you think we have problems with this project? And he thought there was going to be some sort of answer about, well, you know, you got to. He thought there'd be an answer that he didn't get. Because my board president said, the reason you don't want this project here is because you don't like black people, you don't like gay people, you don't like poor people. And I'm just sinking in my chair, thinking, this is not the way I want this thing to go. I realized I had my work cut out for me then. And then a little later in the meeting, at a 75-ish, 80-ish-year-old woman who'd been a neighborhood organizer for years, and actually this piece of property had been vacant for 30 years because they were going to, in the early 60s, put the I-35 right up through this neighborhood in northeast Minneapolis, and the neighborhood fought it back and stopped it. So there was this swath of property that had been destroyed, and this was the last little piece that hadn't been built on. And I knew we were in trouble again, because later in that meeting, the 75-year-old woman got up with her cane, and she said, we could stop the federal government in 1965. We can stop Clare Housing in 2002. And I'm thinking, man, what did I get myself into? But that was an environment where there was a lot of hatred, a lot of anger, a lot of fear. A lot of ignorance. And a wonderful place to practice. A wonderful place to practice. We eventually got the building built, and we are considered quite an asset to the neighborhood now. And people like us, and things are going very well. So that's the first kind of patient. Or I guess I talked about the anger. And so where does the patience come in there? Where does the patience come in? Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, uses the metaphor that it's like salt in a bowl. Anger is like salt in a bowl. If you put a teaspoon of salt in a bowl, the water becomes salty. If you put it in a bowl of water, it becomes very salty. However, if you put a teaspoon of salt in a river, the river absorbs the salt and doesn't become salty. And he talks about when hatred comes at you or anger comes at you, the thing to do is to receive it, to embrace it, and to transform it. Hatred doesn't cease by hatred, but by love alone is healed. As the Buddha said. So as anger comes, you do have choices when anger and hatred come at you. And I think the first choice is to receive it, to open up to it, to relax into it, to feel it. Our normal response would be to tighten up, to push it away, to respond in kind, out of fear. And you do have a choice, and that is to do that. If you can get that little space in there, you know, if you can get the space, you can relax and receive the anger. Those folks were angry. My board president was angry. There was a lot of fear. A lot of hatred. And pouring more salt into that equation wasn't going to do anything. So Thich Nhat Hanh would say, receive it, embrace it, and I would say, receive it and embrace it. I would say, be aware and open. Relax into it. Relax into the fear. Relax into the hatred, anger. And then transform it. And that transformation, I think, happens. It just happens if you don't if you open up to the anger and give yourself some space and notice what it is and notice what you want to do, I think you don't have to add to the anger and hatred. On a little lower amperage example, you know, you're going to make a you get a phone call from somebody who's, you know, doesn't think you delivered that widget on time or didn't get that report in. I mean, a difficult phone call. Sekida describes or talks about one breath zazen, and I think that's what can give you the space to do something other than fan the flames of anger. In those situations, to simply take a breath and notice. I think at that point you have some choices. And I think simply by taking a breath and being aware, you've made a choice. In some ways, you've messed with karma. The examples abound in your daily life. Those times when anger arises or fear arises. I mean, you feel it, you know it. Open your email box and there are 50 friggin' emails. You know. I feel it. Well, you have choices in those. So that's the first kind of. Patience, and that is patience in the face of a bad comment or somebody saying something nasty about you or your children. The second kind is endurance of hardship or bearing adversity without being drawn away from the spiritual path. Endurance of hardship or bearing adversity without being drawn away from the spiritual path. As Isan Dorsey said, Isan Dorsey was a Zen priest in San Francisco. Prior to being a Zen priest, he was a drag queen in the 50s, believe it or not, and druggie. Left all that and became a Zen priest in San Francisco, and then eventually started the Hartford Street Zen Center, which was part temple, part hospice during the AIDS epidemic. And Isan Dorsey had, when he was a drag queen, it was Tommy Dorsey. But when he became a priest, it became Isan Dorsey. He would often say, Isan. People would have a hard time. It's I-S-S-A-N. People would have a hard time with it and say, it's like Pissan. Isan Dorsey. And he had AIDS, died of AIDS. And he said to have AIDS is to be alive. To have AIDS is to be alive. To have cancer is to be alive. It's settling in to adversity and being open to adversity as what is happening now, as is. If you're going to be enlightened, it's going to happen with this skin bag in this moment. And if you have AIDS, that's where it's happening. That's exactly where it's happening. Eitken Roshi said, and he was making the distinction between pain and he was playing with the word suffering. Suffering, dukkha, in Buddhism is kind of all things are suffering. It's the nature of it. And he was playing with a word. He said, the whole world is sick. The whole world suffers and its beings are constantly dying. Dukkha, on the other hand, is resistance to suffering. Again, in this hardship occurs. Suffering occurs. It is the nature of being a human being. It is the nature of being alive. and opening to that suffering, opening our hearts, opening our minds and bodies, and relaxing into it. Patience, forbearance, is what is transformative. Joanna Macy, who is a Buddhist systems woman and activist, does a lot of work around despair, a lot of work around nuclear weapons and nuclear power and despair. And she thinks that we as a people, things are so bad when we kind of, if we think about what's happening to species decimation, global meltdown, all of that stuff, we think about what's happening, the oceans, rainforests, it's real easy to enter despair and shut it off and become numb and just kind of get on with our day-to-day living. And she does a lot of work around, it isn't hopeless, but in order for us to act, we have to open up to the immensity of the despair. And so she does workshops around letting people really feel how things are in the world and our role in it before we can then open up and take action out of love. So rather than shutting down to fear, we need to open up, receive, embrace, and transform. Another little example of that kind of patience, and I have told this story, I think, before. When I was in college, when I was in graduate school, I was in social work, and this was at the time, we have hospice today. It's a wonderful, wonderful program to help folks at the end of their lives and families. When I was in college, we didn't have hospice. It hadn't been invented yet in this country. Actually, it was beginning to be used in the healthcare system. And at the school where I was at, there was a professor of social work who was highly involved in trying to get hospice accepted by the medical establishment. And I was a graduate student. I was an intern at this little seed of a hospice. And this guy had cancer, terminal cancer, and I was assigned as an intern to work with him. And I remember walking into the hospital room, and he had, his wife was there. And I introduced myself as a graduate student in social work working with the hospice. And he looked at me and he said, "So you're the individual who is here to facilitate my ultimate demise." That's patient. I mean, that's to have AIDS is alive. That's in that one sentence, he transformed for me. Well, I mean, first of all, he made me comfortable, feeling a little ridiculous, but comfortable. And he used humor. And he was totally real. And he was transforming his death. I'll give you another example of patience. It was very cold last week. I mean, was anybody aware how cold it was last week? And we can do a lot of things when it's cold. We can bitch. We can get cranky. We can put on long johns. We can do all sorts of things. But I was thinking about, people get pretty miserable when it gets that cold. And I read a poem by Basho as I was preparing for this, and I think Basho uses different stuff. He doesn't use the coal. I don't think he got that coal. But this is in my mind an example of enduring hardship, bearing adversity without being drawn away from the spiritual path. And I think it is as simple and day to day as having it very, very cold or having things not going your way. So the poem goes like this: fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow. He was on a pilgrimage, and he found a place to, a little barn to shack to put his head down at night, and he woke up and he wrote the poem: fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow. He's not complaining there. I don't think he's complaining. He's describing his reality. But I don't get a sense of complaint. And one last thing on this type of patience. We aren't talking about stuffing it. I'm not talking about stuffing your anger. That's not going to do you any good, and it's ultimately not going to do the world any good. I am talking about that transformation of hatred, that changing karma. I mean, that's what it is. It's causes and conditions, and we as human beings have the opportunity to change karma. And I'll never get rid of it. But we don't have to be driven by it. Thich Nhat Hanh says, to suppress our pain is not the teaching of inclusiveness. So he defines patience as inclusiveness. Right? Defines shanti as inclusiveness. So he says, to suppress our pain is not the teaching of inclusiveness. We have to receive it, embrace it, and transform it. The only way to do this is to make our heart big. The only way, in those meetings when we were trying to build this housing for people with AIDS, I felt bloody some nights when I came out of those neighborhood meetings. I mean, that was got to be pretty nasty sometimes. But I didn't see it other than myself. I didn't see what was going on there somehow other than myself. I was participating in the community, figuring out how you house people with AIDS and how you do that when people are fearful and angry. I was part of the process. My heart included everybody, even those folks that, maybe I should have been calling my enemy in that situation. I didn't see them as my enemy. In some ways, I saw them as my dance partner, stepping all over my toes, but my dance partner, nevertheless. So I do. So it's not stuff to this patience or inclusiveness or endurance. I don't want to give you the impression that it's stuffing it. It would be better to blow up. It would be better to blow up. The third kind of patience. I'm actually going to add a fourth, but the tradition has three. The third kind of and Thich Nhat Hanh does not deal with this because I think it's he doesn't deal with this, but in the other Zen writers do. It's patience in following difficult points of Buddhist doctrine, practice, and discipline. It's patience with the practice. It's getting up. It's sitting on the cushion. It's doing retreats. It's doing the work. And patience with that. Forbearance with that. inclusiveness with that. I remember I sit over in the weekdays. I sit in St. Paul in this little meditation center. And I was reminded a couple weeks ago, there's a woman who came to sit with us for probably 4 or 5 years ago, and she's been coming ever since. And we were talking about what a hard time she had with this Zen stuff. Because how she rebelled. I mean, we were sitting facing the wall. By God, she was going to sit facing out. You know, we had our eyes open. She was going to have her eyes closed. And she just was rebelled against kind of the rigidness, if you will, of our look. And we weren't very rigid over there, by the way. I can tell you, we aren't very rigid. But she just didn't. I mean, there was a form, and she was not going to. If there was a form, she was going to rebel against it, and she did for a year or two. And you know, the rest of us were, we didn't respond. You know, we didn't tell her. You know, I got to turn around, got to face the wall. We didn't tell her that stuff. And she reminded me that. She wanted to process what. She wanted to process what went on during meditation. And she didn't know she didn't know why we didn't want to, you know, go out to coffee and talk about what had just happened for the last 40 minutes. But she reminded me that there was one point that was a kind of a changing point for her. We were going out. We were going to the cars, and she said, "Boy, oh boy, my mind was just racing for an hour. It was just racing." And I said, "Sometimes it's like that." And got in my car. And for some reason, that was a turning point for her. Oh yeah, sometimes it's like that, you know. And sometimes it's quiet. But it's the patience with whatever is coming up. And the consistent practicing and sitting down and doing the work. That's the third kind of patience. And I say, and I don't know how many of you know Thich Nhat Hanh, but he tends to see everything on the bright side. And what I like about this is, well, you know, there's a little bit of a Zen need to develop patience for the hard parts. And once you develop patience for them, they aren't hard anymore, although your legs might still get sore. So those are the three traditional types of kshanti: patience, endurance, forbearance. And they are the antidote to anger and hatred. They are the virtue that inspires or transforms hatred and anger. There is a fourth kind of kshanti that I recently ran into, and actually it's what got me to think about doing this talk on kshanti. And it's called, the Sanskrit is Anuttapatika Dharma Kshanti. Anuttapatika Dharma Kshanti. And I translate that as big patience. It's defined as the ultimate insight of patience with the incomprehensibility, ungraspability, or emptiness of any entity or category. Patience with the non-arising of all things. Patience with the non-arising of all things. And what I think, it's equated with enlightenment, patience with the non-arising of all things. Probably those experiences, if we have them, where we are simply present with what's arising, we recognize that what's arising is empty, has no discrete being, and we don't feel like we have to do anything with it. We have no agenda with what's coming up. It just comes up. And we don't insert our ego and think we have to manipulate it, we have to understand it, we have to change it, we have to make it work for us, to push it away. That state of consciousness where we are patient with the universe as it's unfolding, and we just let it be. We don't need to do anything. We don't need to exert any energy. Now, although I did not put together this talk because we have a new president being inaugurated on Tuesday, when I think of Martin Luther King and his attitudes and his preaching and his activities around nonviolence in the face of incredible hatred, anger, decades and centuries of enslavement and humiliation, I think Martin Luther King practiced Kshanti. And I don't know whether he stuffed stuff. Human beings are complicated. But he had, I think, an ability to transform, to take that hatred, receive it, embrace it, and transform it. And I think that Barack Obama is very clearly stands on the shoulders of Martin Luther King. I mean, if it had not been for the civil rights movement, Barack Obama would not be president. And I think Barack Obama's message is consonant or consistent with this perfection, this paramita. Particularly when it is not giving in to anger and transforming it to hopefulness, but also this idea of inclusiveness. And I'm kind of going out on a limit here, but I do think that this paramita is one that Barack Obama appears to exhibit. And I think it's a paramita in this world that we all ought to be inspired by. I'm done. Any questions? Comments?
Then stuff it. Yeah. I'm thinking. I don't know if Tikhon would agree with that. But I know in Buddhist circles and in religious circles, period, there's a lot of talk about not blowing, not expressing anger explosively or destructively. I just wondered if you'd say more about that.
Yeah, I think first of all, I think if you stuff it, ultimately it gets worse. It simmers, it festers, it comes out all sorts of different ways. I don't think you're that's one thing. The other thing is, I guess maybe the better way to say it would be if you're going to be, yeah, I would not recommend being destructive, but if your receive hatred, anger, something that it's probably, if you don't have the capacity, you don't have the space, you don't have the capacity to receive it, embrace it, and transform it, it might be better to express it, to let it burn and be gone, than to sit on it. But do it in do it in a non-destructive way. So blow up might have been the wrong. Beat a pillow, scream at the wall. I mean, without specifics, I don't know.
I can go next.
Okay.
Somebody else. Because, like, in a divorce, it's so normal that you cry and you're in pain in the first few months. And that's because the person cannot stand you crying, so he files a harassment order on you because he can't stand seeing you in a drama or his tears.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you don't have any record, nothing at all, you don't want that.
Mm-hmm. I think. And I don't know in that specific situation, but I think to receive and embrace and transform anger doesn't mean you don't take action. You can still take action, and you can still respond in a rational way. You could even engage in battle, as Martin Luther King did, or in courts. To transform anger doesn't mean you need to be passive. That you can, in love, even as anger comes at you, you can stand up. And out of love, take action that protects both you and moves the whole thing forward. And I don't know, again, in your specific situation, how you might think of that, but I would encourage you not to think about that if there is a threat out there, tend to the threat. Tend to the threat. Pay attention to it and act wisely. But I think it's possible to do that out of a position of love as opposed to anger and hatred. Does that make sense?
You said you try to listen out and you try to explain the door is shut on your face. You cannot explain, you cannot say anything. Return yourself is the most.
Yes.
plow. And loved it, and they had lots of different kinds of people that worked there. I mean, from different religions and everything. And one of my co-workers was a very strict and religious Muslim person. And he knew a lot about plants, everything, and it was wonderful. And finally it got to the point where you only talk about plants so long, and I explored with him about his faith and or what he believed, because I was Christian, and he had more, quite a bit, actually. And I asked him what kinds of things are parallel in teachings about love and forgiveness and when bad things happen in to you. And I said, in Jesus, you know, he talked about, you know, turning the other cheek and, you know, when all of that. And he said, I said, do you have anything like that? And he said, oh, yes. You know, and it was a statement that he, I mean, it was a person in the writings who, and he gave an example. And what that says that this guy was, and his wife and his family were in a remote area, and they were in bed sleeping, and they heard noise outside. And they heard, they looked out their window and saw a cart and a couple of men coming in into their building and starting to take things and all. And he got up and went to the door and opened, I mean, went out there and greeted them and said, oh, it looks like you're moving or traveling or needing things here. Let me help you. And so he started helping him load his stuff up in their cart, you know. And Martessa says, that is sort of what you're talking about, is that you disarm, you talk. Or another way of doing it is to, instead of being angry and mad, which you may feel, sort of, but to engage in conversation and be nice or be helpful, take action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think Martin Luther King did this
mm-hmm.
as well. And I just think that that's a wonderful alternative
yeah.
to stuffing it, or you can say that stuffing it, man, you're being passive, you know, but you're taking action, doing something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that's what you're talking about too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we can use examples of, you know, the grand examples of Martin Luther King. Or, but I, in my day-to-day living, I can see how the Palestinian-Israeli war takes place just watching sometimes what happens between two people. You know, and it, all of a sudden it's just bizarre ill will and hatred. And, you know, I mean, you almost have to admire, you know, how that happens. But so we can talk about Martin Luther King, but how do we bring it down to having somebody rob you or having a situation where you're the door is shut? How do we work with it at that level? And it's I think that's where our practice is. Very few of us will have the opportunity to be a Gandhi or a
My father's 90, soon to be 91, and this past week he's been in the ER for undiagnosed heart issues. And he lives, I mean, well, works for me. But he was home yesterday, and I called and talked to him. And I said, so, Dad, how are you? He said, well, I'm here. And that to me was illustrative of many things you just talked about. While doctors are perhaps picking their hair out about coming up with diagnoses and adjusting his meds, the system was quiet and wasn't standing up. But he's there. I found that very hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that. take one more question or comment, and then. Okay. Yes.
The Dalai Lama has written a book titled "Somewhere in the Middle of It." It's been a long time since I read it. He's writing about all these decisions he should make angry, and then he nicely turns it and he says, "But there are some things in the world that we need to be angry about." And it was like, "Whoa! You know, this is the man who has been so conciliatory around the situation in Tibet," and then he makes that statement. That's the way I really thought for me about, you know, how in Buddhism to do what we're talking about in terms of being patient, but at the same time that there are places that need my righteous anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how then do I do that without being consumed by having to create that suffering inside.
Mm-hmm.